Chapter 19 is a particularly important chapter because towards the end of that chapter we will find a truly amazing affirmation of faith. But in order to appreciate that affirmation of faith and how it was possible for a man in Job's circumstances to make that affirmation of faith, one needs to be aware of the whole series of chapters up to this point, and certainly one needs to know the background to chapter 19. Today we will cover, God willing, the first 12 verses, and as the analysis has been given to you on the whiteboard, if you look at it for a moment, you'll find this chapter 19 can be broken up into 6 sections. Verses 1 through 6 is Job's complaint directed at his 3 friends. And then in verses 7 through 12, there follows Job's lament over God's apparent enmity to him. Take note that the enmity that God demonstrates to Job is apparent. To Job, without knowing what is going on behind the scenes, it would certainly appear as if God has made himself the enemy. Verses 13 through 19, Job mourns the fact that he has been alienated from both family and society. Remember that as a man enjoying a high social standing and elder statesman in his community, the alienation from society is not something trivial. It is not that Job aspired to positions of grandeur or greatness, but he had occupied a position of recognized leadership in the community and had served in some kind of public office. To such a person, being alienated from society is a very terrible blow. And then in verses 20 through 22, which we need to study very carefully, we find just how low a person can sink into spiritual depression. It is perhaps the lowest point that any saint, any believer of God can ever reach. And pray God we are never driven to that point ourselves. But it is in the very, very depths of despair. And out of that terrible depression, spiritual depression, there comes in verses 23 to 27 an affirmation of faith in God, which is completely amazing. So amazing that if God had not somehow given him that understanding, I see no way that a person in the kind of spiritual depression that he was trapped in at that point in time could ever make that kind of affirmation of faith. So amazing is that affirmation of faith that many commentators, if you care to read, would give you the impression that this was not so much a matter of faith in the resurrection, but a matter of faith that his medical problems would be resolved. That is an explanation which I totally reject, and I'm sure all Bible-believing Christians would reject. But you will find such views when you read commentaries. So we need to be aware that the affirmation of faith is exactly what it is. It's nothing more or less than that. And it is amazing, without a doubt, because it comes under the most unfavorable of circumstances. The solution to that conundrum is that it was God-given. Following that affirmation of faith in verses 28 through 29, Job ends with a warning to his friends to desist from condemning an innocent person. Today we will look at the first 2 sections, verses 1 through 6 and 7 through 12. Verses 1 through 6, first of all, his complaint directed at his three friends, and we will take each section as far as possible, verse by verse. Verses 1 and 2. Then Job answered and said, "How long will ye vex my soul and break me in pieces with words?" First thing to note is the use of the plural form ye, Y-E. In modern English, we would use you, but the complication or the confusion is unlike the precision of using you for singular and ye for plural. In modern English, it is a standard you, which could be singular or plural, depending on the context. So in Job's case, as the KJV have correctly rendered the Hebrew, it is the plural form which is used as an address, indicating that he is directing his statements at all three of his friends. This is significant because in chapter 18, he had been so badly wounded emotionally by the harsh and uncalled for criticism of Bildad. So one would think that in chapter 19, his words are directed to just Bildad alone, but no, the use of the plural form ye, corresponding to the Hebrew, indicates that he is addressing not just Bildad, but all three of his friends. However, there is a little bit of sarcasm which our friend Job resorts to, because in verse 2 he begins with, how long will ye vex my soul? And if you cast your mind back to chapter 18, you will find that friend Bildad, in that earlier chapter, full of uncalled for and very harsh words, had a number of times asked Job this question, beginning with, how long? And so Job perhaps is mimicking that how long of Bildad. So yes, his complaint is directed at the three friends, but we can see hints that he is focusing in particular upon Bildad, because that was the most recent attack upon his integrity. The words of Bildad in chapter 18. How long, says he, will ye vex my soul? The phrase "vex my soul" implies that the distress caused to him is primarily mental and emotional, not physical. And this corresponds perfectly with the Hebrew yaga, which refers always to emotional pain or anguish or distress. So their verbal accusations and condemnations, which had come thick and fast, if you remember the three friends, the words that came from them were like the stream of bullets from a machine gun. No let up, it's a continuous discharge of ammunition. And that kind of verbal barrage from three trusted friends, from three different directions, so to speak, is an extremely difficult situation to face, a very painful situation. And as a result of that verbal barrage, he had really been shattered emotionally. Hence he says, "How long will ye vex my soul? How long will you cause me this acute emotional distress?" And that is parallel by the second half of verse 2, "and break me in pieces with words." So very clearly he's referring to the acute distress he has suffered as a result of this verbal barrage from three different quarters. Verse 3, "These 10 times have ye reproached me. Ye are not ashamed that ye make yourselves strange to me." We need to spend a little time on this verse. There are three expressions that hold the key to the specific meaning of verse 3. The general sense of verse 3 even if you don't appreciate the nuances of it, the general sense is reasonably clear. He's basically saying, now we shall need to consider what the 10 times means, but if you let that pass for a moment, he's saying, you have been reproaching me, you have been accusing me, and I am innocent. Are you not ashamed that you have adopted this stance? That's the general sense, but there is a lot more to it than that. We shall go step by step. First and foremost, 10 times. If you count the number of times, it is definitely not 10 times that they have reproached him. So we are to understand by the expression 10 times simply a euphemism for many times, many occasions. It would correspond to our use in modern English of the expression, I have a couple of questions to ask you. Couple of questions can be 1, 2, 3, and generally up to 4 or 5. And all that is subsumed in the phrase, I have a couple of questions. So 10 times is the Hebrew equivalent for saying, many occasions you have reproached me. What does this reproach mean? The reproach is more than just an accusation. And here we need to be aware of the Hebrew word which is used in the text, which is kalam. And this Hebrew word specifically refers to the wounding of one's spirit through a specific channel. And what is that channel? It is through public humiliation. The accusations and words of the friends were directed at Job, not in private, but in open, in public, so anybody who was passing by could hear. And certainly he was outside the city gates. Certainly there was constant traffic into and out of the city, and everyone who passed by would surely look at the spectacle of the former elder statesman of the city reduced to a broken, shattered, worm-ridden, worm-infested body sitting on the garbage dump. So for sure, the words of the friends would have been public knowledge. Everyone would be talking about how Job's 3 best friends, even they are reproaching him. So in the Hebrew, kalam refers not just to an accusation, not just to a complaint, but specifically to a public humiliation. These 10 times have you reproached me. You have on so many occasions publicly humiliated me. That is the meaning of the word reproach in this context. Ye are not ashamed that ye make yourselves strange to me. This is the difficult part. What does it mean? I can guarantee that it's a completely baffling statement, and indeed it remains so till today to some extent. So we need to go back to the Hebrew. The word corresponding to strange is the word haha, H-A-K-A-R, and haha means specifically hardened. But in what sense? It is difficult to say. The reason is that this word occurs just once in the entire Old Testament, right here in Job 19. And this makes it very problematic to interpret the word, where you only have one usage of the Hebrew word in the entire Old Testament. It is pretty difficult to figure out exactly what the original writer meant. The general sense may be clear, but we need to know exactly what it means. So linguists who have studied the etymology of this word have compared it with a very similar word in Arabic. And Arabic is also a Semitic language coming from the same family as Hebrew. And comparing it with the corresponding Arabic word, they have suggested that the word haha means in this context harden one's heart. If we were to accept that proposal, then verse 3 could be read in the following way. In the original KJV, it would be, just to remind ourselves, these 10 times have ye reproached me, ye are not ashamed that ye make yourselves strange to me. So if we accept the proposal that hachar is related to the Arabic, which means harden one's heart, then verse 3 could be read as, you, plural, you have wounded my spirit by repeatedly humiliating me in public. You have all hardened your hearts so as to look upon an innocent man without any compassion. Makes sense. But then the question arises, how did the KJV translators come up with the rendition, make yourself strange? One possibility that has been proposed is that, again, the difficulty for any translator is that this is the only occurrence of the Hebrew word hachar in the entire Old Testament. Therefore, as professional translators would do, they would look at cognate words, and the possibility exists that they may have looked at a very similar looking Hebrew word. If written out in the Hebrew, it would look very, very similar to this word hachar. And it is the Hebrew word nachar, which means to be strange or foreign, to alienate oneself from. So perhaps the KJV translators, trying to find the most appropriate meaning, looked at the cognate word in Hebrew, nachar, which means strange or foreign, and gave a literal rendition in English. You cannot fault them for that, because this is the one and only occurrence of the word, and it would pose a difficulty to any translator till today. And because the notes of the KJV translators have not apparently survived, there is no way that we can know the sequence of thought that led them to propose this rendition. So we need to accept that they acted in good faith, and we try to understand the verse 3, guided by the context. And if that is the case, then I propose the following rendition of verse 3. The three of you, that makes it clear he's referring to the three friends, the three of you have wounded my spirit by repeatedly humiliating me in public. That is close to the Hebrew original. And the second part, you, again the three of them, you have all hardened your hearts so as to look upon an innocent man without any compassion. So in a sense, the KJV translators are correct, because this attitude of the three friends have alienated them from Job. They have themselves made themselves strange in that sense, if you like to think of it that way. That illustrates the difficulty sometimes of studying the Old Testament text. There are a few words, thank God there are very few occurrences of words like hachar, which technically are called hapax legomenon, meaning to say it's the only occurrence of a word in a given text. Those words are very few, and when we come across them, there will be difficulty in interpretation. We need to be aware of that. So the best rule in such circumstances is, what is the general trend of the context? It is that which is going to guide us, and is generally the safest rule to follow. Now we are on to verse 4. And be it indeed that I have erred, mine error remaineth with myself. Again, what does Job mean by using the word erred? Is he talking about sin? Is he talking about just a mistake? So here it is not just the context alone, but it is the actual Hebrew word that must guide us. The Hebrew word that is rendered as erred is the word shaga. The primary meaning of shaga is not willful sin. We must be very clear about this. It is not willful, planned, premeditated sin, but shaga always refers to unpremeditated sin, sin committed inadvertently, on the spur of the moment, unplanned. It is that kind of sin. So Job is saying that even if I have committed such sins, the consequences of it, the error remaineth with myself. Meaning to say, the consequences of such sins I am fully prepared to bear. Bear in mind a very important point. Job has never ever claimed to be sinless. When he talks about himself as having no sin, when he talks about being perfect before God, and even when God calls Job in the face of Satan, hast thou considered my servant Job that he is perfect and upright? What it means is that Job does not carry within himself unconfessed sin, and equally that Job has consistently dealt with sin in his life in the way that God has prescribed. How? By repentance first, then by confession to God, and appropriate to Job's time, followed confession, repentance, confession, followed by the appropriate kind of sacrifice as God had directed. And you will realize from the early chapters of Job that long before the Mosaic law was given, God had already instructed his believers on earth that sin is so grave a matter that it has to be accompanied not just by repentance and confession, but by a blood sacrifice. So that, in a way, prefigured the final atonement for sin that Christ would achieve. So long before the Mosaic law, the making of a blood sacrifice as a final step in the process of getting right with God, repentance first, followed by confession to God specifically, and then by sacrifice, was already well established in the practice of the believers. So when Job claimed that he had no sin in his life, all he's saying is that he does not, as far as he can tell, have any secret sin within him, and equally that he has always dealt with sin in the God-honoring, God-prescribed manner. So it is in that overall sense that he claims to be perfect. So what Job is saying, or in a sense, what Job is saying in verse 4 is that whatever sins I have committed, if I have not confessed it and repented and confessed of it, then those sins have never been willful, premeditated sins. At most, they have been inadvertent sins, sins committed out of ignorance, out of a moment's weakness. Long after Job, the Levitical system recognized that human beings, given their nature, even with the best of intentions and with all the effort they may try to make, they will still sin. But hopefully those sins will be sins of ignorance or of inadvertence. And for those kinds of sins, as contrasted with willful sins, there is a specific type of sacrifice prescribed under the Levitical law. And if you are interested, you can take a look at Leviticus chapter 4, verses 2, 3 and following. Let me just read a short extract to you. These concern sins of ignorance, inadvertent sins. Reading the extract, if a soul shall sin through ignorance against any of the commandments of the Lord concerning things which ought not to be done and shall do against any of them, then let him bring for his sin which he has sinned a young bullock without blemish unto the Lord for a sin offering. So yes, even the later and more elaborate Levitical law recognized that human beings, even with the best of effort, under the best of conditions, will stumble and fall. But at least they should be able to say with all honesty, Lord, this was something that I sinned out of ignorance. Please forgive. So what Job is saying is that any such sins that may remain that you, my friends, can accuse me of would be sins of ignorance, this category of sins. And if there are such sins, I accept full responsibility for them. What I reject, says Job, what I reject is you, my friends, trying to ascribe to me secret sins as the explanation for all the afflictions that God has sent upon me. That, says Job, he totally rejects, because till this point in time his conscience is completely clear. There is no secret premeditated sin which could explain such a torrent of affliction coming upon him. So that is the meaning of verse 4. Verses 5 and 6 need to be taken together. If indeed ye will magnify yourselves against me and plead against me my reproach, know now that God hath overthrown me and hath compassed me with his net. I draw your attention to a few specific phrases. Magnify yourselves against me. What does this mean? You will recall that the friends had set out at the very beginning to commiserate with Job, that is, to sit down and to sympathize with him and to share in his suffering and sorrow and to strengthen, comfort, uphold him. But what has happened is that they had instead taken on a censorious attitude, sitting in judgment and criticism upon him, and therefore talking down to him. And this has hurt Job very much. It is in this sense that the friends have taken upon themselves to be like the censors, the judges of Job's life and character, that he says that they have magnified or exalted themselves above him, because they have somehow put themselves up there and are talking down to him as if Job is a terrible, wretched sinner, which he is not. The next phrase that I would like you to look at is, plead against me my reproach, that is in verse 5. What does this mean? This means that the friends have taken Job's afflictions at face value without looking deeper, and they have automatically concluded that all these afflictions coming thick and fast upon Job constitute proof, which we know that it is not a proof, but to them it was proof enough that Job was indeed guilty before God. So that is what he means when he says that his friends are pleading against him, his calamities, his reproach. They are taking the afflictions that have befallen him as a combined proof that he is guilty. you will recall again the operation of this famous law of double retribution, which I have mentioned enough times that you may be sick of hearing it. But the problem is that it is one of the threads that runs through this whole book. The whole confusion of Job, of the three friends, and indeed even of Job, is because of misapplying the law of double retribution. And to a sense, to a certain extent, that problem also is with us today. We tend, and we have to be very careful about this, we tend to look upon someone who is going along steadily, doing well, and suddenly suffering affliction upon affliction. The tendency is to say, aha, this person has done something wrong and God is judging that person. But that would be the exact same mistake that Job's friends are making. What right do we have to be censors looking upon a person who is suffering and saying, oh, you have secret sin in your life, that is why all these afflictions have come upon you? The classic example is the case of my elder sister, who is unfortunately a Pentecostal member. When 12 years ago she contracted fourth stage of colon cancer, the church, from the pastor down to the members, crowded around her bedside, and it amazed me to hear them accusing her of secret sin. Because of some sin in your life, God has sent stage 4 cancer upon you. This is exactly the mistake made by the friends. The law of double retribution does indeed work, but it works on God's time scale. The wicked will never get away with it. Proof, Psalm 73 and many other proofs. The truly godly and righteous are sometimes called upon to suffer far more in this life than the ungodly. But then change your perspective. What is important to you? Is it this 70 years or the eternity that is to follow? Unless, of course, you reject the eternity, then you reject the faith, you reject Christ, you reject God, and then anything goes until the day of judgment. But if you accept God for what He is, if you accept Christ for what He is and what He did, if you accept the Christian faith for what it is, then you have to accept the fact that the 70 years are nothing more than the batting of an eyelid against the time scale of eternity. Do you want to exchange everlasting blessings and joy and peace with God for a few short years of apparent prosperity and comfort? That is really the heart of the question. If you misapply the law of double retribution, you will automatically say, I am not sure about, you will apply this famous proverb, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. Therefore, let me think. I am not sure about eternity and all the blessings because it's not tangible. There's no one who went there and came back to give us proof. Perhaps only Paul did, but Paul has very little to say about it, the Apostle Paul. So really, it's nice to know about the eternal blessings, but that's something very far removed. But blessings here and now before my eyes is something tangible. Bird in the hand is perhaps worth more than two or many in the bush. So given a choice, should I take blessings here and now and forego the promised blessings for eternity, which is only a promise and there's no tangible evidence or proof? So really it comes down to making that choice. Job and all true believers before and since made the correct choice, that they gave up the pleasures of earthly life for the sake of enjoying an eternity of blessings with their Heavenly Father. So really what Job is saying is, you cannot take my calamities at face value and accuse me of secret sins. Now comes a very interesting part in verse 6, the first half of verse 6. Know now, that is, be properly advised that God has overthrown me and encompassed me with his net. We need to be careful here, because if you read it wrongly, it would appear that Job is accusing God of becoming his enemy, his hunter. But is Job really saying that? Let's look at this phrase, God has overthrown me. First and foremost, what does overthrown really mean? The Hebrew word is avah, which literally means to make crooked or bent or to turn upside down. And yes, Job's whole life has been turned upside down. So that's appropriate. An example, two examples of the use of this word avah are to be found, one in Ecclesiastes, the other in Isaiah. Let me read to you Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 3, reading an extract. The strong men shall bow themselves. In this case, bow themselves because their knees become weak, and so they are bent over. So this is one meaning of the word avah, to make crooked or bent. The other meaning which I mentioned, being turned upside down, is that which is used in Isaiah 24, verse 1. Again, reading just an extract. Behold, the Lord maketh the earth empty, and maketh it waste, and turneth it upside down. That is the Hebrew word avah. So because there are other examples of the usage of avah, the spectrum of meaning can be very readily identified. In contrast with that earlier word, hachar, of which there is only one usage, and that can cause a fair amount of confusion. God has overthrown me. What in Job has been overthrown? He himself has not been overthrown. Because if he himself has been overthrown, the implication is God has given up on him. And that is the situation that Satan wanted to see happen. Satan wanted to maneuver, manipulate Job, as Satan did the three friends, so that Job would say or do things that would compel, as it were, God to say, I give up on you. And once God takes that approach, there is no going back. That person is lost forever. And that's exactly what Satan was driving towards. So what in Job's case was turned upside down? Not the man himself, but rather his prosperity was overthrown, was turned upside down. His high social standing is now reduced to nothing, ashes, is overthrown. His health has been overthrown. His whole body is wasted and worm-ridden. So it is these external circumstances, his prosperity, his high social standing, his health, it is these that have been overthrown, but the man himself has not. And I cannot emphasize this too strongly, Job himself has not been overthrown. God has overthrown me and has compassed me with his net. What is Job referring to here? Job may be referring to Bildad's speech in the earlier chapter, in chapter 18, in which Bildad had correctly observed that very often the wicked, those who devise all kinds of evil schemes, very often they are caught in their own trap. They are caught in their own net. So Job may be alluding to that speech of Bildad. Chapter 18, verse 8. For he, the wicked, is cast into a net by his own feet, and he walketh, he steps onto a trap. But God has compassed me with His net, and He is not guilty. So what does Job mean by using this expression? Job is saying that his conscience remains clear to that very day, that there is no secret sin in him. Yet it is God who has been pursuing him like a hunter, and it is God who appears to have cast a net around him that has entangled him and has now prevented him from moving, from doing anything, from even escaping. And to make matters worse, God has withheld from Job his reasons for acting in this way. Unfortunately, Job is oblivious to the machinations of Satan, and he will remain so to the end of this book. But really, if Job had been given a little insight, he would have changed his line of argument. Yes, the circumstances appear to project God as the one who has been pursuing like a hunter an innocent man, Job. That's the circumstances, the appearance, and it's the result of not knowing what is going on behind the scenes, which we do. So we cannot accuse Job of saying the wrong things before God. Because if you and I were caught in that situation, we would feel exactly the same way. Because everything points to God really chasing after us and hitting us from all quarters like a highly skilled hunter. There may be times in our lives when we are called upon to receive suffering in that way, and we need to be aware from the book of Job that it is never God who is pursuing us like a hunter. For reasons that God has not made clear, He sometimes ordains that that kind of suffering come upon His children in this earthly life. At the rock bottom, all our arguments, all our protestations of innocence is really hollow because of the sin of human nature. You and I can never escape the fact that there was sin in us when we were conceived. There is sin in us all through our earthly life. And therefore, if we want to be very legalistic about it, if God wanted to take the same approach like us and be legalistic, God would tell us, on legal grounds, wages of sin is death. There's no basis for me to do anything for you. So really, all our protestations of innocence, God, you've been unfair to me, you've treated me unfairly, why have you allowed this suffering? The answer to that, if God wanted to be very firm about it, would be, you deserve far worse than this, so shut up. You deserve far worse. And really, we would have to shut up. We have no grounds to accuse God of being unjust. Job knew that well. What he is describing are the experiences of a person to whom this flood of afflictions coming upon a person whose conscience is clear, it looks like he's being pursued by a relentless hunter. And it is that appearance which makes the suffering even more difficult to endure. If Job knew, if we knew for sure that in a specific case our afflictions are caused by Satan, I can guarantee that that suffering is so much easier to bear because we can identify with Satan. He is the enemy of the human species anyway. He is my personal enemy. And it is not surprising that he wants to attack me, and God has permitted it. So we can identify adversary and innocent victim. We can identify. But when we are not aware or we cannot put the finger on Satan, then we do not know to whom or to what the cause of our suffering is to be attributed. And it is that uncertainty that exacerbates the degree of suffering. This is part and parcel of human nature. We can't run away from it. So, unfortunately, Job does not know about the machinations of Satan, so that adds to his suffering. Chapter 19, verse 6, the very first phrase in that verse is "know now." Why do we need to note that phrase? Because it connects with what is to follow in verses 7 through 12. In order that his friends may appreciate the scope and the magnitude of the calamities that God has visited upon him, he being innocent, Job now in the following verses, actually verses 7 all the way through 20, is going to follow up with a meticulous accounting of these afflictions. Today we will just cover verses 7 through 12. And in that section, Job will lament over God's apparent enmity towards him. Verses 7 through 12. "Behold, I cry out of wrong, but I am not heard. I cry aloud, but there is no judgment. He hath fenced up my way that I cannot pass, and he hath set darkness in my path," meaning to say, I can no longer discern the right way. "He hath set darkness in my path. He hath stripped me of my glory and taken the crown from my head. He hath destroyed me on every side, and I am gone, and mine hope hath he removed like a tree. He hath also kindled his wrath against me as we would kindle a fire, and he counteth me unto him as one of his enemies," as one of his enemies. "His troops come together and raise up their way against me and encamp around about my tabernacle." This passage is full of very graphic, very poetic metaphors. So we need to be aware of these metaphors in order to appreciate not just the meaning but the beauty of the passage. Verse 7, "Behold, I cry out of wrong." What is this wrong? Again, English is not as rich as Hebrew. So to get the full flavor of this word, we need to go back to the Hebrew original. In the Hebrew text, the word rendered as wrong is Hamas. Not the Hamas that is in Lebanon today, though it has the same name. The Hamas in Hebrew means violence. So that raises a problem here. What on earth is Job saying? Hamas is violence. How does that connect with God? All he's saying is that it is not that God is violent towards him like a madman, but rather that God has dealt with him in an apparently very rough way, which is correct from Job's point of view. He's really had a very rough deal in life, if you want to think of it that way. So that's all he's saying. And to make it worse, he has been crying out for relief. He says in verse 7, "I cry aloud, but there is no judgment," meaning to say that no relief is coming even though I keep crying out. With reference to these two verses 7 and 8 in Job, we can note that very similar sentiments are expressed by the prophet Jeremiah. So really, Job is not alone in feeling like this in those circumstances. So because even Jeremiah, in similar circumstances of acute suffering, tended to feel that it is God who has acted very roughly towards him. Lamentations chapter 3, verses 7, 8, and 9. "He," that is God, "hath hedged me about that I cannot get out." Isn't that what Job has been saying? "He hath made my chain heavy," which reinforces the idea of being so trapped, so bogged down by this net that you can't move. And also, Jeremiah says, "When I cry and shout, he shutteth out my prayer." Isn't that also what Job says? "I cry aloud, but there is no judgment." And then Jeremiah continues, verse 9, "He hath enclosed my ways with hewn stone with huge boulders which have been purposely cut so that they fit together and they constitute a rock solid wall around me. He has made my path crooked. Crooked meaning they are littered with sharp stones so that I cannot walk straight. It's not necessarily that the path is crooked, but because of the very sharp stones that God appears to have strewn along that path, I cannot walk straight. I have to hop from side to side. So in that sense, the path is crooked. So you can see the beauty of the metaphor there. So really, the comparison to Jeremiah is to illustrate the fact that in similar circumstances, any man of faith, any woman of faith would experience feelings not so different from Job. So please do not blame Job for being hasty. Verse 9, he has stripped me of my glory and taken the crown from mine head. What does Job mean? The glory and the crown, basically he's referring to the fact that God has taken away from him, from Job, Job's exalted position as an elder statesman in his community. As an elder statesman in his community, it was his privilege to sit in a special seat in the gate of the city. From that, he has now been reduced to a special seat on the city garbage dump outside the city. So isn't that being stripped of all his glory and having the crown removed from his head? So again, the metaphor is very appropriate. And then he says, he has destroyed me on every side and I am gone, and mine hope has he removed like a tree. What does he mean by that? A hope, my hope has he removed like a tree. The comparison with the tree is to be understood like this. If you cut a tree down, but you leave a stump, you can be sure that after several weeks, shoots will start to grow. The only way to get rid of a tree completely is to dig it out from the roots as far as possible. If you do that, even if some roots remain behind, you will never see any shoots sprouting again. So what Job is saying is his hope has been torn up as it were from the roots, so that there is practically no opportunity for that hope ever again to be revived. And not surprisingly, because the state that he is in, he has no reason to expect that things would be put right. What hopes is he referring to? His hopes of being restored to family and society, his hopes of having a healthy body again, his hopes of being once more recognized as an elder statesman in his community, his hopes of seeing his grandchildren all gone, because all his ten children are gone, 7 sons and 3 daughters killed in one fell swoop. So he's no way he's going to see his grandchildren. So all his hopes have been terminated in a manner that, like a tree plucked up from the roots, those hopes would never revive again. And then finally in verses 11 and 12, he has also kindled his wrath against me. The he is obviously God, and he counted me unto him as one of his enemies. His troops come together and raise up their way against me and encamp round about my tabernacle. Again, the series of metaphors is employed by Job. Job compares God to a general commanding an army. In besieging a fortified city, the tactic would be first and foremost to surround the city walls with sufficient troops so nobody goes in, nobody comes out. And then a select band of those troops with their battering rams are going to hammer away at each of the city gates again and again, wave after wave. At some point, one set of gates somewhere is going to break and give way, because the battering is incessant. So what Job is saying is, God seems to have marshaled all his forces against me, as if I am like a fortified city and I need to be besieged and attacked in that way. But the tragedy, says Job, is I am not like a city. My life is nothing more secure than a tent. That is the meaning of the use of the word tabernacle. If you go back again to verse 12, his God's troops come together, raise up their way against me, and encamp round about my tabernacle. Here is marvelous irony, because it may be appropriate for a general to use the full force of his army against a fortified city. But if he is attacking a group of people, nomads living in a tent, you don't need that kind of ammunition and size of force to attack a group of nomads. It's like saying, if you want to get rid of a sparrow or a minor bird that's causing you trouble, a catapult will do. You don't need a rifle and a bullet. So God is coming against me, says Job, with all these forces, heavy armor, and my life is nothing more secure than a tabernacle, a tent. God doesn't need to attack me with this kind of force. Again, it is apparent, because ask ourselves now, what or who is really the enemy of Job? Who is it who has been marshalling such an array of very frightening and terrible weaponry against Job? Is it God? Or is it somebody else? And the answer to that is to be found in Job chapter 2, verses 3 and 4, and then 5 and 6 and 7. Job chapter 2, 3 through 7. And the Lord said unto the adversary, the Satan, in the Hebrew it should be the Satan, hast thou considered my servant Job, that still, I'm reading an extract, that still he holdeth fast his integrity, although thou movest me against him to destroy him without cause? And Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin, yea, all that a man hath will he give for his life. But put forth thine hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse thee to thy face. And the Lord said unto Satan, behold, he is in thine hand, but save his life. So went Satan forth from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot unto his crown. It makes it perfectly clear that the real enemy who has been marshalling such powerful forces against Job, launching attack against attack upon Job and reducing to this point of almost total despair, is not God, but it is Satan. The tragedy of this whole experience is that Job is and will remain ignorant of Satan's involvement. So we shall end with verse 12 of chapter 19.